Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. It's a pretty simple question, really. Can Congress get it done in time? Hopes for a new economic package on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday today, the 20th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin this week at the end of July in a year ain't none of us going to forget by pointing out the enduring reality of this economy. 32.5 million Americans aren't working. They are trying to get by on expanded federal unemployment benefits. Expanded in who can get them. Gig workers, the self-employed, people who can't go to work because school is closed or because somebody in their household is sick, they all get them. Those benefits are also expanded in how much people can get. That's the extra $600 a week you've been hearing oh so much about here and elsewhere. You've also been hearing, I'm sure, that the last of those checks go out in like a week unless Congress and the White House decide to do something. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
Back in March, Austin, Texas was gearing up for the annual South by Southwest Festival. And everyone, theater folks, waiters, bartenders, car share drivers, was about to be working round the clock for a whole month and making a significant chunk of their annual pay. Then COVID-19 hit.
When the city announced that that was going to be shut down, it just pulled the rug out from under everything.
Stephen Pruitt's a lighting designer and videographer. He had gigs set up for South by Southwest, and then he was going to China with a Texas tap dance troupe. Instead,
myself and everyone else just lost every job that we've had.
Before the pandemic, he'd have been out of luck. Freelance workers aren't typically eligible for jobless benefits. But Washington made them eligible and added $600 a week to everybody's unemployment checks.
It's been the difference between, you know, paying my rent and eating versus not.
If Washington doesn't extend the $600 a week pandemic payments, come August, Pruitt will be getting a Texas-sized unemployment check of $200 a week.
Like, at that point, then I'm probably still paying my rent, but I may have to talk to my bank about, can I defer my car loan? Okay, I can still survive, but now I'm going to be figuring out how to prioritize which bills to pay.
All over the country, people in states with comparatively low jobless benefits, like Texas, will face a 50 to 75% pay cut at a time when getting a new job isn't necessarily easy or safe, says Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation. And that means
people worried about losing their housing, having to move in with relatives, you know, not really be able to get by on unemployment benefits.
Stettner says losing the federal supplement will suck $25 billion a week out of the economy, money people spend right away on essentials, rent, food, transportation. The money is also keeping some small businesses alive, like Anna Zebley's bakery in Kansas City, Missouri, where she is cook, server, and business manager. When the state shut down, she got on pandemic unemployment.
It's gone towards shop expenses. I mean, I still have to pay rent even when I'm closed and utilities and all that since I haven't had any revenue, really.
When the state reopened, she was no longer eligible for unemployment. So she reopened, fully masked, takeout only.
And then Monday, I woke up with flu symptoms and went to the doctor and I'm presumptive positive.
She's quarantining now and her shop is closed. If she doesn't start getting unemployment payments soon, she's not sure she'll be able to reopen. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Exactly how much spending power that extra $600 gets you varies a whole lot, of course, depending on where you are. Our colleagues at the APM Research Labs up in St. Paul have built an interactive map that'll give you some sense of it. You can check that out at marketplace.org. Should say here, by the way, that there are talks set on a new economic package tomorrow up on Capitol Hill. The GOP wants to hold it to $1 trillion. Democrats in the House have already passed a package at $3.5 trillion. Those, obviously, are the starting points. Stop me if you've heard this one before, but traders on Wall Street today took hope in some promising vaccine news, never mind all that actual economic uncertainty. We will have the details when we do the numbers. You know what we haven't seen in a good long while? A big energy merger is what, which makes sense. Of course, these are dark days in oil and gas. So it was with some surprise we learned Chevron is going to buy an independent oil and gas producer called Noble Energy for about $13 billion all in. A sign, perhaps, that though oil is down, it is not out. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
When oil prices fall sharply, that's usually followed by a wave of mergers and acquisitions, says Jim Burkhard of IHS Market.
The big oil companies of today, in fact, are the result of oil price weakness in the late 1990s when we saw a big wave of mergers.
When oil prices plummeted back in April, even going negative for a day, they dragged down the value of smaller energy companies. Tom Tsang is the director of the School of Energy at the University of Tulsa. He says Chevron likely saw a deal and pounced on it.
All energy company stocks are down. So to some extent, it is a somewhat of a bargain purchase, I guess you could say.
But in the last few weeks, oil prices have settled at around $40 a barrel. Tsang says if oil companies like Chevron are looking to acquire other energy companies,
at least right now, your thinking has to be the prices will continue to slowly but surely move up. And so if you don't act now, you're going to pay for it in the future.
Oil prices could always fall again or just stay put for a while. Economist Philip Verleger says Chevron is likely most interested in Noble Energy's oil reserves in Colorado, West Texas, and abroad.
And these are reserves that can be produced profitably at $40 a barrel.
But not for all oil companies. Michael Weber is an energy professor at the University of Texas. He says we're likely to see more oil company bankruptcies and more acquisitions as companies try to figure out ways to make drilling more efficient.
And one way to lower the cost and achieve greater efficiency is to consolidate, to have some companies come together so they can share resources.
Weber says Chevron's deal is a sign that there is still life in the oil industry. Even as the pandemic has kept people at home, he says demand for gas, diesel, and jet fuel hasn't gone away. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
U.S. benchmark, should you be curious, closed right around $40 today in New York, $40.69 a barrel. Pretty much, as Justin said, where it's been for a couple of weeks now. The longest undefended land border in the world. Go ahead. See if you can guess which it is. I'll wait. Longest undefended. The U.S.-Canadian border is what I'm talking about. It's been basically closed, although undefended, since March. And on Friday, the two sides agreed, Essential Commerce accepted, to keep it closed for another 30 days at least. You might have seen the Toronto Blue Jays are not going to be playing ball in their home stadium in this virus-shortened season. Too risky. Apparently, to allow people from down here to get in up there, it seems. And as Marketplace's Eric Barris reports, the closure has hit the economics of border towns real, real hard.
Summer at Niagara Falls is usually pretty lively. Restaurants full, the bridges that link the U.S. and Canada packed. This year, though?
Right now is peak season, and you're probably seeing about 10% of what you'd normally see.
That's Gordon Stevens, who runs a Niagara Falls travel website and books boat rides and tours. He says his business is down by 95% this year. Last year, 46,000 busloads of Canadians crossed bridges into Western New York. Since March, not one. Catherine Friedman is a fellow at the Canada Institute who lives in Buffalo. She says now that those buses have disappeared,
That means that restaurants and casinos and tourist attractions are, you know, obviously losing millions of dollars in revenue.
Annually, 20 million Canadians visit the U.S. On average, they spend almost $1,000 here at baseball games and rock concerts, outlet malls, and big box stores. And they come to pick up things they've purchased online. A lot of small border towns in Washington depend on that, says Lori Troutman, who runs the Border Policy Research Institute at Western Washington University.
These towns have built up industries around Canadians, right? I mean, those industries wouldn't exist, particularly the online mail order, like P.O. Box industry, if we didn't have so many Canadians coming down.
The absence of Canadians is hurting a lot of industries along the border, says Christopher Sands, who runs the Center for Canadian Studies at Johns Hopkins University.
They provide the restaurant revenue. Maybe they're people buying gas that contributes to a local gas tax.
And that's hurting state and local governments that rely on those taxes. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
A lot of workers are saying, no, I refuse to go back.
They are indeed. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 8 points today. A little changed, one might say, 26,680. The NASDAQ jumped 263 points. That is 2.5%, 10,767. The S&P 500 found 27 points, 0.8%. 32.51. Amazon added 7.9% today after an analyst at Goldman Sachs raised its target price. The top advertiser on Facebook for the first half of the year? Walt Disney, which is now slashing its Facebook ad spending. That's according to the Journal. Facebook added 1.4% today. Disney shaved off about 0.7%. eBay said to be near a deal to sell its classified ad unit to a Norwegian company for about $8 billion. That classified unit operates mostly in Canada, Australia, Mexico, and parts of Europe. eBay shares up 0.5% today. Bonds rose, yield down 0.61%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. I've mentioned a time or two on this program, I believe, that I'm a history guy. So now, an interview that starts, in a way, back in the 1880s, when white-owned insurance companies started charging black people higher premiums than their white customers. Some of those companies refused to write policies for black people at all. So in that way that capitalism has, enter in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, black-owned insurance companies selling policies to a waiting market. Robert Weems is a professor of business history at Wichita State University. Professor, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
Black-owned insurance companies started their operations in a deeply segregated America. How did they do as a business proposition?
Well, as a business proposition, these companies were able to find a good niche in the insurance marketplace. And I think an indication of just how viable these companies were in their heyday was that we know, for instance, during the Great Depression, that pretty much signaled the end of a majority of African-American owned banks, but most of the African-American insurance companies were able to survive the Great Depression pretty much intact.
Yeah, but you look around today, 80 years on from that or whatever it is, and there aren't that many black-owned insurance companies around. What happened?
Well, interestingly enough, the improving social condition of African-Americans with the Civil Rights Movement caused large insurance industry giants to reconsider their discriminatory practices against African Americans. We saw the industry giants aggressively pursue the African American consumer market. And from the standpoint of African American consumers, it became a literal status symbol that they were being marketed the same types of policies that companies like Prudential and Metropolitan Life sold to their white clients. And another part of this story was that they literally recruited top black agents from black companies to sell policies in the African American community. And there's a real irony in this, especially going back to the context of African Americans viewing equitable policies as status symbols. We literally saw large companies able to profit from previous discriminatory practices.
Much is made the last, you know, number of months about the racial wealth gap in this country, right? This, I imagine, somehow plays into that. Could you, first of all, am I right? And second of all, could you explain how?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. In fact, when we look at African-American insurance companies, we're talking about companies that had, you know, millions of dollars in assets, had hundreds of millions of dollars of insurance in force. And when these companies disappeared from the, you know, the landscape of American business, necessarily this had a negative impact on wealth creation in the broader African-American community. One of the beauties of the insurance business, especially from the standpoint of profitability, is that at any given moment in time, there are more people alive paying premiums than there are people dying, and companies have to pay death benefits. So one of the things that insurance companies have to deal with, unlike a lot of other businesses, is how do they disperse surpluses? And historically, African-American insurance companies dispersed a lot of their surpluses into the African-American community in terms of mortgage loans and other types of capital needs of African-American communities. And I would argue that it's not coincidental that as we've seen the decline and disappearance of African-American insurance companies, we've seen a simultaneous decline in the infrastructure and ambiance of African-American communities across the country.
Yeah. Let me ask you, if I could, on the way out here, a question about this moment. And I ask it of you with all your study of business history in this economy. What are your hopes for black capitalism coming out of this moment?
Well, my hopes, first of all, is that when we look at, you know, African-American businesses, you know, while there are some very large and very influential black enterprises, a significant number, just as in the broader economy, are small businesses. And unfortunately, when we look at, you know, African-American small-owned businesses, a lot of these entities really haven't gotten access to, you know, the PPP program and other things put in place to help small businesses survive. So, you know, one of my concerns is that hopefully there will be a black business community in place a year or two or 5 years from now, considering, you know, all the pressure that small businesses in general and small black businesses in particular are dealing with at the present moment.
Professor Robert Weems, he's a professor of business history at Wichita State University. Professor Weems, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate your insights.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Parts of this pandemic economy make some sense in their lackluster performance. Just, for instance, like car and truck sales being down more than 30% in the just-ended second quarter over a year ago. Makes some sense, obviously, because if you're not driving much in quarantine, one does not need a new car or a truck. Now, though, even though people are mostly allowed to go out again, one might reasonably imagine general economic agita would keep the near and medium-term future of the car and truck business grim. But one would be wrong if one thought that. There's a new report out showing people are starting to look at cars even as more essential than before, in part to avoid taking public transit and ride shares. Marketplace's Jack Stewart has that one.
Doug Gordon lives in Brooklyn, and he's never really seen the need for a car before. But now, he and his family are considering getting one to escape the city. Not hugely surprising until you learn how anti-car he is.
If someone like me, who literally hosts a podcast called The War on Cars, is entertaining the idea of getting a car, certainly then people who are not as well-versed in a lot of the issues and the problems surrounding automobile use in cities, they're probably thinking of it too.
And there's new data to back that up. A survey due out tomorrow from auto buying portal Car Gurus looks at consumer sentiment around vehicle buying. Madison Gross from the firm says, before the pandemic, a lot of the talk was about the end of personal car ownership.
But right now, all of the data I see is really indicating that we're moving in the opposite direction, where cars are even more relied upon.
39% of people planning to buy cars are looking to avoid ride sharing. Nearly half say they want to avoid public transit. And when everyone goes back to offices, this trend could increase. Michael Simons from Elucid, a research firm.
44% of people who take public transit cited public transit as their top concern about returning to the office.
By the way, Simon's another previously car-free Brooklyn resident, and he's just leased a car. But Rebecca Lindland has been an auto industry analyst for long enough to have seen previous trends come and go, like in 2008 when people started buying small, fuel-efficient cars.
That only lasted 3 to 4 months, and then they went back to buying a vehicle that suited their wants and needs.
If parking and traffic become tough, then the shine might fade from private car ownership. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Whether you're ready or not to go in and eat at a restaurant, they are open, restaurants are, in one form or another in every state. Open, though, does not mean busy. Restaurant traffic is down 60% or more, depending on where you are. And if you happen to work in a restaurant, you know tips are down even more. So, some restaurants have started rethinking how they are paying their staffs, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Before the pandemic, Colleen's Kitchen in Austin operated like most restaurants in Texas. It paid servers $2.13 an hour, which is the minimum wage for people who also get tips. But these days,
there's just not enough business to be able to pay somebody a living wage.
Ashley Frick owns the restaurant with her husband, and she says they started to wonder if they could keep paying staff the way they always had.
And the answer in pandemic times is no, you cannot pay somebody $2.13 an hour and hope that guests come in the restaurant.
So they decided to change things up. Now, instead of the tipped minimum wage, they're paying everyone on staff between $15 and $22 an hour. And they're not the only ones.
There's an increasing trend of employers paying a full minimum wage.
Saru Jayaraman runs the nonprofit One Fair Wage, and she says a lot of small and medium-sized restaurants, especially in big cities, are offering servers more to make up for lost tips and make it worthwhile for them to come back to work.
We are seeing a tremendous change. Our organization has been approached by literally hundreds and hundreds of restaurant owners asking for our help to transition to a full minimum wage successfully.
Tips have always been an unpredictable way of earning a living. And Emmanuel Munoz, who works at a restaurant in Brooklyn, says it's even worse now.
You have people sometimes over tip, you know, like more than the 20%. And that's awesome.
But for every generous tip, he says,
you have 10 customers that don't tip you anything.
The restaurant where he works is trying to make up for that by paying workers more per hour. But even so, Munoz says a lot of his coworkers who are getting unemployment haven't wanted to come back. Saru Jayaraman of One Fair Wage says that's happening a lot, particularly in places where the tipped minimum wage is just a few dollars an hour.
A lot of workers are saying, no, I refuse to go back and put my health at risk and my family's health at risk for $2, $3, or $4.
While a lot of restaurants have raised wages for now, the question is whether that will last. Most are struggling financially, and the Paycheck Protection Program, which has been helping a lot of restaurants make payroll, is running out. But Ashley Frick in Austin says her restaurant, Colleen's Kitchen, has figured out a way to keep paying servers more.
We've added a 20% service charge to all dine-in guests. And that additional revenue for the business allows us to turn around and pay our staff a living wage.
And she says they're planning to keep doing that, even after the pandemic is over. Emmanuel Munoz hopes the restaurant industry as a whole moves in that direction. He says it's never felt great to have to rely on tips.
Why do I have to wait for a Friday night with a full restaurant so I can see that I'm going to be able to have enough money for savings or for rent?
Especially now that restaurants won't be full for a long time. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which may well be, even after everything that has gone on so far this year, this may be the sign the apocalypse is upon us. Kentucky Fried Chicken, KFC, is the actual approved branding, I think. Anyway, KFC, here's the news from a press release headlined Meat of the Future. The company is working with a Russian 3D printing firm, and here's the quote. Using additive bioprinting technology using chicken cells and plant material to reproduce the taste and texture of chicken meat almost without involving animals in the process. Now, yes, industrial chicken farming is unpalatable at best. But. All right, we are out of here. The big news on Wall Street today, the NASDAQ up 263 points. That's a new record high, 2.5%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.